From NPR and Chicago Public Radio, this is Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, the NPR News Quiz. I'm Carl Castle, and here's your host at the Chase Auditorium in downtown Chicago, Peter Sagal.
Thank you, Carl. Thank you, everybody. Thank you so much. We've got a great show for you today. New York Times columnist Maureen Dowd will be our guest later on to play Not My Job. But first, a really sweet note. We got a nice email this week from a woman who told us that she decided to mention her interest in our show on her online dating site profile. And her response rate improved amazingly, she says. All of a sudden, she was contacted by two men who she thinks either one of them could be her soulmate. She indicates that she's going to bring each one of them here to see us live, you know, to find out, to which I say, listener, you know, I wish you the best of luck in your search for love. And Carl, how many times have I told you to stop fooling around on Match.com? While we wait for that denouement, it's your turn. Give us a call. The number, 1-888-WAIT-WAIT. That's 1-888-924-8924. It's time to welcome our first listener contestant. Hi, you're on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.
Hi, Peter. This is Jill Irwin in Richmond, Virginia.
Hey, Jill. How are things in Richmond?
Fantastic.
What do you do there?
I work as a sports writer at the Richmond Times-Dispatch.
Oh, really? What's your favorite sport? What do you cover?
I cover NASCAR.
You really? You're a NASCAR correspondent?
I am indeed.
Wow.
I would not go so far as to call it my favorite sport. However.
Oh, I see. It's more a job.
Yes.
Yes, I understand. Well, welcome to the show, Jill. Let me introduce you to our panel this week. First, say hello to a deputy editor at the Houston Chronicle, Kiri O'Connor.
Hi, Kiri.
Hi, Jill.
Next, say hello to the humorist and author, most recently of P.J. O'Rourke on The Wealth of Nations, Mr. P.J. O'Rourke.
Hey, Jill. It is possible to combine, despite the laughter of our audience, it is possible to combine a fondness for NASCAR with listening to NPR radio.
Well, and of course, they both turn to the left, so it's...
Oh! Hey-o!
Also say hello to a writer for the Boston Globe and the author most recently of Moving the Chains, Tom Brady and the Pursuit of Everything, Mr. Charlie Pierce.
Hi, Charlie.
Hi, Jill.
Jill, welcome to the show. You're going to start us off with Who's Carl This Time. That's when Carl, of course, recreates three voices from the week's news. Your job, correctly identify or explain just two of them. Do that, you will win our prize. Carl's very own voice on your home answering machine. Ready to play?
As ready as I can be.
All right, here we go. For your first quote, we give you the Vice President of these United States, Mr. Dick Cheney.
So?
That was Mr. Cheney's reaction this week after he was reminded that a majority of Americans are not happy that we're still doing what after 5 years?
Fighting in Iraq.
Exactly right. This week, Mr. Cheney left Washington to celebrate the fifth anniversary of the day on which the Bush administration made sure it would not be best remembered for its poor handling of the 2001 Chinese spy plane incident. Cheney traveled to Iraq by having the senior leadership of that country draw a pentacle on the floor and summon him. While in the Middle East, he was interviewed by ABC's Martha Raddatz, who pointed out to him that despite his latest claims of vast success in that conflict, quote, Ms. Raddatz said, 2/3 of Americans say it's not worth fighting, unquote. Mr. Cheney replied, so? He pointed out, this is true, he said, well, Abraham Lincoln didn't pay attention to polls when he was fighting the Civil War, which is true. It may have had something to do with the fact that it was hard to conduct polls via telegraph. And that by the time the fifth anniversary of that war was marked, it had been over for a whole year.
Yeah, you guys make fun of Cheney. But where's your Democrat that shot a lawyer?
That's true.
Show me that.
That'd be Aaron Burr, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I know. All right, very good. Here is your next quote.
This guy makes Louis Farrakhan look like Hello Kitty, and we're going to have a field day with this.
That was a GOP consultant talking to the Washington Post, and despite a big speech this week, Republicans are planning on using Barack Obama's association with somebody against him as long as they can. Who is this alleged extremist?
That would be his pastor, Jeremiah Wright.
Very good, Reverend Wright. Well done.
We, the members of the panel, we had a bipartisan political discussion before the show, and we decided as Catholics, we really couldn't get too down on somebody about what their clergy did.
That's true. What happened was that for more than a week, the cable news networks have been constantly replaying old home video of Obama's preacher and spiritual mentor, Jeremiah Wright, saying some extremely angry things about America and white people. Obama was on the defensive for a while on this issue. He hinted, you know, that during the most angry sermons, he was busy playing Minesweeper on his BlackBerry, so he wasn't paying attention. But then he responded with a big speech in which he rejected Wright's comments, went on to talk about America's racial legacy and how we all need to move beyond it. But even if Obama survives this controversy, GOP activists have other attacks ready to go. Apparently, Obama's barber has made some inflammatory comments on the Cubs' chances this year. According to sources, his dentist once made some very off-color remarks about Britney Spears, and all Obama said in response was, oomph, 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 oomph.
But he said it very well.
He did. He was so articulate. All right, very good. Here is your last quote.
Got to get you out of my life.
That was who Al Moore. That was the headline writer's joke du jour this week. It was everywhere. It was how they all described the final divorce settlement of whom?
Paul McCartney and Heather Mills.
You know both their names. Well done. The storybook romance between the former Beatle and the former model ended with the judge in their divorce, granting her a $48 million settlement. It wasn't the $250 million that she had asked for, but it does work out to about $34,000 a day for the marriage. Not bad work if you can get it, even if it does require you to listen to endless whining about how the songwriting credit should have been McCartney and Lennon. Even in granting that judgment, the judge said that Mills, during the procedure, had been, quote, inconsistent, inaccurate, underhanded, and less than candid, unquote. When last seen, Ms. Mills was seen hanging around Ringo Starr's house.
I think Sir Paul there gets the, kind of retires the cup for it seemed like a good idea at the time.
Yeah.
Paul, there's this one-legged crazy girl we'd like you to meet. I've been that drunk.
Carl, how did Jill do in our quiz?
Jill did very well, Peter. She had three correct answers, so I'll be doing the message on her home answering
machine. She takes the checkered flag.
She does. Yay! Well done. Well done, Jill. Thank you so much for playing. Right now, panel, time for you to answer some questions about this week's news. PJ, last week, New York Governor Elliot Spitzer resigned after it was revealed he had repeatedly hired prostitutes. So on Monday, David Paterson was sworn in as New York's first African-American and first legally blind governor. And in one of his first acts, he stood before the press and announced what?
That he'd had affairs, that his wife had had affairs, that goldfish had had affairs, the gerbils. And that they'd had the governor of New Jersey, the former governor of New Jersey, and his wife over for the weekend.
Exactly.
And this is all available on YouTube.
That's right, PJ. His affairs in what may have been the most exciting thing ever to happen in Albany, New York. Governor Paterson announced that both he and his wife had had multiple affairs some years ago during what either was a hard time in their marriage or their marriage's total rockin' high point, depending on your point of view. The couple said that it was all behind them now, that they were faithful to each other and would be so until death or until they got a look at next year's crop of interns.
You know, being in state government's got to be, like, really easy because at the end of my workday, I'm tired. I mean, they must have a lot of reserve.
Well, anyway, the governor was, of course, trying to get this all out in the open so there'd be no surprises, and they scored points for it. They were asked what message that by making this announcement they wanted to send to the children of New York State. The new First Lady of New York said, quote, in a marriage you're going to have peaks and valleys, but you want to show them how you get through them, namely seduce the staff until the feeling passes.
Yeah, this is not the best message for the kids. Kids.
Kids, no.
Don't try this at home.
Or at work.
Or in the Days Inn in the Upper West Side, which is apparently right now. Charlie, we're happy to report that Henry, a 111-year-old rare lizard, kept in a zoo in New Zealand, finally did what?
Made romance with the lady lizard.
Yes, he did. It may just be that this week the world's oldest virgin finally hit the jackpot. They've been trying to get this lizard to mate for years. It's a rare species. They've supplied it with willing females, mood music, a subscription to Cinemax. Nothing worked. Finally, a keeper discovered Henry in flagrante delicto with Mildred, a sweet, young, 70-year-old female. A keeper said, and this is a quote, "I'm just totally chuffed at what I've been trying to get from old Henry ever since I started looking after him. It's a major, major thing. He's never made it in his life here that we know of. He's looking out there with a wee smirk on his face now." Thank you, Garl. Right now it's time for the Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me Bluff the Listener game. Call 1-888-WAIT-WAIT to play our game on the air. Hi, you're on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.
Hi, I'm Stacy Luttrell in Rockwall, Texas.
Rockwall, Texas?
Yes.
I always ask this sort of question, but is there a rock wall in Rockwall, Texas?
Oh, my goodness. There is a myth of a rock wall.
Really? A myth of a rock wall?
Texans are very practical about their names of towns.
Mm-hmm.
I live next to Fate, Texas.
Fate?
Yes.
You mean like the fickle finger thereof? Fate?
Yes, and then you're in fate.
You're in fate. Wow. But
Americans got west of the Mississippi, and they just run out of all the city names.
Exactly.
You know, they used Athens and Troy and Rome and stuff, and so you start, the farther west you go, it gets, you know, like, lost my hat, New Mexico.
Seriously, but it's a lovely place. I love it here.
That's great. Well, welcome to the show, Stacy.
Thank you.
You're going to play the game in which you must try to tell truth from fiction. Carl, what is Stacy's topic?
To dream the impossible dream, to fight the unbeatable foe,
to go where the brave dare not. I'm sorry, I was carried away.
Yeah.
Anyway, back to you. The world is a big place, and it's got an awful lot of problems. It seems daunting sometimes. This week, though, we read an inspiring story about somebody on a quest, a mission to change the world in at least one important way. Our panelists are going to tell you three stories of passionate people out to make the world a better place. Choose that real story. You'll win Carl's voice on your home answering machine.
All right,
ready to play?
Yes, I'm ready.
First, let's hear from P.J. O'Rourke.
Miss Gladys McEwen, the 78-year-old proprietor of a dressmaking shop in Cherry Hill, New Jersey, is well known for her concern for local youth. In an interview with Jersey Magazine, she said, "I see these young men with their pants all too big and baggy and practically falling off them, and these poor girls with blouses that don't fit and leave their tummies showing, and I just bring them right into my store and give them a bathrobe to wear while I take those pants in at the waist and hem those cuffs and sew on a couple of rows of ruffles to cover the girls up. They all look so much nicer." Ask if she had ever encountered any resistance from the young people involved. Miss McEwen said, "Oh, no, dear, I have a gun."
A woman in Cherry Hill, New Jersey, who's doing something about today's fashions, one pair of pants at a time. Your next story of dreaming the impossible dream comes from Charlie Pierce.
The yellow traffic light is the perfect example of the difference between the concepts of de jure and de facto. Its de jure meaning is caution, slow down. Its de facto meaning is go faster, the light's about to turn. Except in Massachusetts, where it means look, in the crosswalk, fresh meat. Bob Lysander, owner of Suter's Bar and Grill in Pewaukee, Wisconsin, is on a crusade to restore respect to the yellow light. Any driver who slows down or stops at a yellow at the intersection outside his bar, Lysander runs out and gives the driver a certificate for a free bratwurst dinner. He's trying to get other merchants at other intersections in town to do the same. "We need civility and respect for the rules of the road," he said, "and who better the bartenders than get that rolling?"
A campaign in Pewaukee, Wisconsin. We'd have people honor the yellow light. And your last story of a mission impossible comes from Kyrie O'Connor.
You know how nuts you get, how much you die inside every day when you drive past the sign for the Convince store, when you know it's a convenience store? Jeff Deck hates it even more. Deck, who is of course from Boston, got with three buddies to form the Typo Eradication Advancement League. Their pledge, to take chalk and pen and write grammatical wrongs coast to coast for 3 months. Kind of like Superman, John Brown, and Strunk and White all in one crazy quixotic crusade. Deck especially hates stray apostrophes, the eternal misunderstood punctuation mark, he calls them, which means he's never had a kid in public school because teacher's notes would just make him curl up like a weevil.
Okay, Stacy, let me review your choices. From P.J. O'Rourke, the story of a woman in Cherry Hill, New Jersey, who's trying to fix those baggy pants those kids are cursed with. From Charlie Pierce, the story of a bartender in Pewaukee, Wisconsin, who's rewarding people who stop at yellow lights with bratwursts. And from Kiri O'Connor, the story of a man who's on a national quest to end typos in signage in our time. Which of these is the real story in the week's news?
I have the feeling it's the middle story, but goodness, that would just, a bartender that has time to do that is might as well just close up. Oh, my goodness, do I try to win?
You spent much time in Pewaukee, eh?
Oh, dear.
What do you think? You have to pick one. So you.
I think it's, number two, the middle one.
Okay, so your choice then is Charlie's story. All right. Well, yeah. To bring you the real answer, we are actually able to get this brave and lonely crusader on the phone.
When somebody misspeaks, it's a mistake that only lasts for a moment, but typos like De Beers diamonds are forever.
I'm so sorry, Stacy, but Kiri, in fact, had the right answer. You did earn Charlie Pierce, though, a point for his somehow appealing story of bratwurst for yellow lights. So if only that were true. Thank you so much for playing.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye. And now the game where we ask people who usually think about big issues to come on and think about little tiny ones. In 1999, New York Times columnist Maureen Dowd won the Pulitzer Prize for her columns on the Monica Lewinsky scandal. Her specialty is examining how the personality flaws of politicians shape their public actions. And ever since, politicians have been doing their best to give her more and more material. Maureen Dowd, welcome to Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.
Thanks, Peter.
I went back and I reread those Pulitzer Prize-winning columns back from 98 and 99. You, among other things, were really seemingly angry at Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton at that time for what you felt that they had done and what they were trying to get away with. Do you ever look back at those columns and see if they hold up by your own lights?
No, I try to save emotions like anger for boyfriends.
Oh, I see.
No, I don't. I think of, when I critique politicians for abuse of power or whatever, I do it in a more reasoned way.
You do say, you have said, and probably will continue to say, some pretty harsh things about the politicians you write about, their personality flaws. Does this ever cause you a problem? Have you ever offended somebody so much that it became a problem in your future relationship with them?
Well, there was that time when Monica Lewinsky kind of confronted me in this Indian restaurant that's next door to the New York Times.
Yeah.
And, the piano player was playing Sid and the Clowns, and suddenly I saw her bearing down on me.
No, you are making that up.
And I realized there was no way I could take her. She was a very tall, imposing girl. And
she came right up and said,
why are you writing about me? I didn't know how to explain. She was in the middle.
Okay, let's start at the beginning.
All right.
Yeah.
This is going to take a while to explain.
Well, did you talk to her? Did you explain yourself? Did you engage with her?
It was like the Cowardly Lion, like I'm top in print.
Oh, yeah.
My whole career, I thought maybe somebody would come up and throw a drink at me, like in Appointment in Samara. But she didn't throw a drink at me. I said to her that actually I was trying to defend her because it was actually the Clintons who were trying to demonize her as a troubled girl who was stalking the president. And that hadn't seemed to occur to her, so...
Yeah, there's a lot of things didn't occur to her, I think.
Yeah, exactly.
In terms of, I'm sorry.
To be fair, a lot of things didn't occur to him either.
Yeah, that's
true.
I wanted to ask you this specifically. I mean, you have written about sex scandals. I mean, I wonder if you have any particular insight that the rest of us don't into, shall we say, oh, I don't know if you heard about this, Governor Spitzer's problems.
Oh, Lord, Peter.
No, I mean, in the sense that you've covered so intently these politicians and their psyches. I mean, people associate this with men because it's men who do it, but is that because it's a male behavior or is it because it just happens to be that men are in the position of power? Do you think once we have women routinely in positions of power, we'll start seeing female-centered sex scandals?
Well, when you think about Elizabeth I, as played by Bette Davis, you know, she was always kind of mixing up sex and politics and sending off her lovers to the Tower.
I like to think of Gwyneth Paltrow when I'm not sorry. I like to think of Kate Blanchett when I think of Elizabeth I and sex.
Weren't
but that's
those
just me.
Movies?
Yeah, but I think it actually happened in real life.
Oh, okay.
And, well, in real life, Catherine the Great, she was very sexually rapacious, and certainly Cleopatra combined sex and power better than anyone.
It's hard to believe it never happened with Margaret Thatcher.
Well, you know, I do know for a fact that Ronald Reagan had a little sneaker about Margaret Thatcher. He thought she was very attractive because one of his national security guys told me he told him that.
Wait a minute.
I think
Ronald Reagan was a handsome single guy in Hollywood in the 40s. And he thought Margaret Thatcher was good-looking?
No, later, when they were, you know, Margaret Thatcher was very kind of flirtatious with Reagan in these summits, and, you know, he felt very protective.
I have to tell you, everybody in this theater has their head between their knees right now, trying to catch their breath. It was just something like, okay, wait a minute.
Good-looking, I bet it looks good.
All right, that's exciting.
You know, if Thatcher and Reagan had bread, you Democrats would be really frightened.
It's alive!
Exactly.
I just want to ask you one last thing before we play the game. You got a delightful letter this week in response to one of your columns. You had compared George Bush, our president, in making a speech in which you say he was avoiding all kinds of responsibility and just sort of tap dancing around. You compared him to Gene Kelly, if I remember.
Yes, no, it wasn't a speech. It was when he was actually tap dancing in front of the White House.
Oh, excuse me. I forget.
He was waiting for John McCain, and he did this kind of soft shoe. And then he went to the gridiron and sang a cowboy ditty. And everyone was a little bit kind of flummoxed because the dollar's crashing and the Dow's crashing and we're going into a recession or depression. And Bush just seems to get happier and happier. So I said he has... You know, and everyone's trying to figure out, you know, what it's like the line in Harry Met Sally. What's he having? I want some of that.
Exactly.
So I just said he had become Gene Kelly. And Gene Kelly's wife, Patricia Kelly, wrote a charming letter to the editor where she said, you know, she knew Gene Kelly and the president was no Gene Kelly.
Well, nonetheless. Maureen Dowd, we have asked you here to play a game we're calling...
If you're the guy who thought up communication satellites, I want to know why I still can't get the game show channel.
This week, the world lost Arthur C. Clarke, visionary author of the book and film 2001, A Space Odyssey, as well as many other books, and he was a man who was able to describe the future before it got here. We're going to ask you three questions about the late Mr. Clarke. Get two right, you'll win our prize for one of our listeners. Carl, who is Maureen Dowd playing for?
Maureen is playing for Elisheva Blass of New Haven, Connecticut.
Ready to play?
Yes.
Here we go. First question, here we go. Mr. Clarke's most famous achievement was writing the novel, 2001, co-writing the screenplay for the great movie that Stanley Kubrick made from it. Being involved, though, with that movie brought Clarke fame as well as some problems, such as which of these? A... Whenever he made a public appearance afterwards, he was always serenaded with the music Thus Sprach Zarathustra, the theme from the movie, which he absolutely hated. B, once when visiting the United States, he said that the immigration officer told him, I'm not letting you in unless you explain the ending of that movie. Or C, IBM, noting that the homicidal computer in the movie is named HAL, that's one further down the alphabet than IBM, H-A-L, they sued him for defamation.
Wow. Am I allowed to ask PJ for help?
Oh, yeah, good luck.
I am the perennial loser at this.
God, they all sound good. All right, let's say B.
You're going to go for B, the immigration officer?
Yeah.
You're right.
Wow.
All right.
You're right. The immigration officer said, I'm not letting you in unless you explain the meaning of the movie. By the way, Mr. Clark always said the meaning of the movie is really simple. Humans evolve from apes to astronauts to a star child. There.
There you go.
What's the big deal? Next question. Mr. Clark is credited for popularizing the idea of geosynchronous communication satellites way back in the 40s. These days, they're up there, you know, shooting radio shows, among other things, to your home. Later in life, he had another visionary technological idea that he really believed would someday revolutionize the world. What was that idea? A, elevators that would go all the way to outer space. B, vast orbital mirrors that could warm the planet, increasing arable land and ending the miseries of winter. Or C, delivering mail around the planet in a matter of hours by robot rocket ships.
Okay, B?
You're going to go for B, vast orbital mirrors that could warm our planet, because that would be a good idea?
Yeah. No, that's not... Oh, wait, maybe it's not B. Okay, what was C again?
I don't know.
C was...
I'm for that, you know, but...
C, he envisioned robot rockets that could deliver a piece of mail in 2 or 3 hours, all it would take to get it halfway around the world.
C?
You're going to go for delivering mail around the planet? That's your choice?
No. A.
A. You're going to go for A. We've eliminated the others. You're going to go for A, elevators into orbit?
That doesn't sound likely, does it?
Oh, you got to choose, Maureen.
Okay, B.
B. You're going to go for B. The orbital mirrors. No, it was A. It was the elevators. Elevators to orbit.
It
turns out... I think in order to credibly claim that you knew it, you have to do better than picking it third out of three. But no, your choice was B. The elevators, you see, it turns out that if you were able to get an elevator all the way up there, it would stand up because the top of the elevator would actually be in orbit around the Earth, you see.
Oh,
it would be stable if you could just make something strong enough. All right. This is great. Last question. You get this right, you win it all.
Oh, gosh.
In addition to technology, Clark was also a visionary when it came to human society. Sometimes. Sometimes he got it wrong. At least as far as we know so far. Which of these was a prediction he once made? Was it A, that by 2001 humans would have figured out how to grow babies with gills so we could live underwater? Or is it B, that by the 1960s we would be able to use apes and monkeys as personal servants? Or C, that war would be obsolete by the 21st century because every human being would have access to a nuclear weapon and the risk would be too great?
Okay, I'm going to go with C.
You're going to go with C. He predicted that everybody would have their own personal nuclear weapons, so therefore war would be obsolete.
I don't know, C.
You're going to go for C? That's your choice? Personal nuclear weapons? Color coordinated with your outfit?
Such a cool idea.
Yeah. Well, it's an idea he should have had, even if he didn't.
You're going to go for C?
Yeah.
I'm afraid it was B, apes and monkeys as personal servants.
No!
He said, this is back in the 1950s, he said, quote, with our present knowledge of animal psychology, we can certainly solve the servant problem with the help of the monkey kingdom, unquote.
Oh, my God.
He then went on to say, indicating perhaps that he might have been joking, that we'd have to then deal with the monkeys unionizing. Carl, how did Maureen Dowd do in our quiz?
Well, Maureen needed at least 2 correct answers to win for Elisheva Blast, but she had just 1 correct answer.
Oh,
Thank you so much. That was fun.
Maureen Dowd is a Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist for The New York Times. Maureen, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you, everybody. In just a minute, Carl will amaze you with his skills as a master impressionist. It's another edition of Who's Carl This Time. If you'd like to play, give us a call at 1-888-WAIT-WAIT. That's 1-888-924-8924. Right now, though, panel... some more questions for you from the week's news. PJ, online job site CareerBuilder.com recently surveyed hiring managers and came up with a list of the top 10 most outrageous interview mistakes. Among them is a job candidate who told an interviewer that his boss fired him from his last job for doing what?
This one went right by me, and I can see from the look on Carrie's face that she knows. She's not going to give me a hint. Fired him for, I don't know, you know, going postal and killing a lot of the employees in the firm.
You know, that's not exactly right, but I'm going to give it to you because I don't want to hear the rest of your guesses.
Fair enough.
Fair enough. What he did was he beat up his last boss.
That's pretty close.
Yeah. Not only do prospective employers frown on applicants who say negative things about previous employers, according to CareerBuilder.com survey, it's really bad to admit physically harming your previous supervisor. Don't do it. Among the other choice mistakes, a candidate who brushed her hair during the interview, a guy who during a phone interview flushed the toilet.
That's not good.
No. But I think I'm better off for not getting that job. A woman applying for an accounting job who admitted that she wasn't, quote, a numbers person.
I'm a people person.
And an applicant who declined an offer of food because he didn't want to, quote, line his stomach with grease before going out drinking. Charlie, we read about a scientific study this week that proved once and for all that short people are far more likely than their oversized counterparts to be what?
Intelligent, sensitive.
Thoughtful. I was doing thoughtful here.
Thoughtful's good.
I was miming thoughtful.
Sexy.
Drop dead sexy.
Silent.
Drop dead sexy. That's right. Yeah.
Nice boyfriend.
Nice boyfriend.
Fat. Overcompensating.
Fat.
No, not fat.
I thought I'd actually guess.
I'll give you a hint. They don't really know what you're doing up there, but they're afraid you're doing it with somebody else.
Oh, they cheat?
No, you bah food. Short people are more inherently likely to be jealous.
Oh.
That's what the study says.
Jealous? Why would we be? I mean, we've got everything going for us. Jealous of what?
We're more compact. Researchers at the University of Groningen in Valencia put their heads together, thought hard, did some amazing research, and concluded the shorter you are, the more likely you are to be jealous. The researchers asked 549 men and women to rate how jealous they felt, and the tall, lanky people tended to be much less jealous than their gnomish, troll-like counterparts. The scientists say this makes evolutionary sense because previous findings show that the tall guys really do get all the babes. This also explains another common phenomenon seen in bars, women flirting with men, and then their boyfriends jump out of their purses shouting, "Aha, I knew it!"
That's true. We are jealous because unlike the tall people, we all have to ride around in one little car.
It's terrible. Kiri, a restaurant owner in Massachusetts who walked in on a robbery fought off the thief with what?
I don't know the answer to this. Let me think of something. I'm going to think, and with my mind, I'm going to think of the answer.
You've been watching too much Baby Einstein.
But spray cheese?
Ooh, good one. Good one.
I love it. Yeah. I love the idea. No, you're close. Anybody know?
He fought him off with food.
He fought him off with specifically what, do you know?
I can't remember now. A hamburger.
Oh, you're so close.
A hot dog.
No.
Leg of lamb.
Oh.
That'll work.
That'll work.
A ham.
Hey, a ham, yes.
Ham.
He fought him off with a ham. And here's the best part. The store owner had the ham. The thief, a big piece of prosciutto. So Joe Scola goes to investigate a suspicious noise in his restaurant. He found himself face-to-face with the thief escaping with an armload of meat from the meat locker. And so he's caught. The intruder picks up a 5-pound prosciutto log. It comes at Mr. Scola, but Mr. Scola knows that prosciutto is no match for a big frozen American ham. So they went at it with pork products. The intruder dropped the cold cuts and fled the scene.
But then his wife ran in with the spray cheese.
I eat meat. I like it red. I like it dead. I like it plain and neat on my plate. Oh, I like to chew a little moo that now has turned to steak. I love meat. That old prime rib will fill my jib till I'm stretched out nice and tight. I eat meat most every night.
Coming up, it's lightning fill in the blank, but first it's time for Carl to recreate some more voices from the week's news. If you'd like to play on air, call or leave a message at 1-888-WAIT-WAIT. That's 1-888-924-8924. You can send an email to waitwait@npr.org. You can also go to our website at waitwait.npr.org, where you can find out about attending our weekly live shows here at the Chase Auditorium in Chicago, where you can visit the NPR shop to pick up your Wait Wait tchotchkes. Hi, you're on Wait Wait, Don't Tell Me.
Hi, this is Simon from Seattle.
Hey, Simon, how are things in Seattle?
Things are pretty well. We've had some nice weather.
Really? Oh, yeah, it's that time of year where you actually get some.
That's right. I've actually just moved here, so it's nice to enter Seattle with a little nice weather.
No, where did you move from?
I came from Rwanda.
Rwanda. That's a change.
So you're not that bummed out by bad weather, I don't know.
Simon, it's nice to have you with us. You're going to play Who's Carl This Time. Carl Castle once again is going to read three quotations from this week's news. Your job, correctly identify or explain just two of them. If you do that, Carl will record the greeting in your home answering machine. Ready to play?
Ready as ever.
All right, here's your first quote.
No, no, no. It's fine. Don't take your money out of it. Don't be silly.
That was CNBC's Jim Cramer just last week assuring everyone that despite rumors of impending collapse and bankruptcy, a certain company is just fine. Don't take your money out. Don't be silly. What company?
Bear Stearns.
Bear Stearns, exactly.
All righty.
On Monday, we woke up to find out that the venerable Wall Street investment bank, Bear Stearns, had been bought for $2 a share by another bank and that the federal government had put up $30 billion to guarantee the purchase. Because why? Because if Bear Stearns collapsed, then the Framet Index would kerfuffle the mortgage glamgen, and pretty soon we'd all be eating our sneakers. That, by the way... best I could do, is a more sophisticated analysis than was offered by the President of the United States, who basically said everything would be fine with our economy because the Treasury Secretary worked over the weekend. And that, quote, showed the country and the world that the United States is on top of the situation, unquote. Well, they're working over the weekend at Starbucks, too.
In fact, that's where the Secretary of Treasury is working right now.
I'm not sure we should put them in charge of the economy. Maybe we should, though. At least then, for our $2, we'd get a cup of coffee.
Should I be alarmed, by the way, that JP Morgan bought?
Yeah, JP Morgan.
That JP Morgan spent less for Bear Stearns than the Yankees spent for Alex Rodriguez?
It's a little terrifying that this company, which had been a multi-billion-dollar capitalization the Friday before, went for nothing on Sunday because it was
closed
like
above $71 a share on Friday. It closed, and on Monday morning, people woke up and their shares were worth $2.
Right.
So technically, Alex Rodriguez could have bought Bear Stearns?
Yes. Yeah.
That's amazing.
Woo! Yeah.
Here is your next quote.
It's common knowledge and has been reported in the media that Al-Qaeda is going into Iran and receiving training.
That was someone in the Middle East this week getting it wrong. Iran is not training the Sunni fighters of Al-Qaeda. No, Iran supports Shia fighters in Iraq. Who got into a little trouble as he dipped his toe into foreign affairs?
That would be John McCain.
It was. Senator McCain has staked his claim in the presidency on his foreign policy expertise, so it really didn't look good when he went to Iraq and got that whole Sunni-Shia thing totally backwards. It was actually kind of a classic comedy moment, though. Immediately after misspeaking in front of the press, his buddy Joe Lieberman leaned over and whispered in McCain's ear. And then McCain nodded and then said, quote, I'm sorry, I am told Iran is arming the Shia extremists, you Mashugana al-Dakakar, unquote. And then he looked around and said, was that wrong?
Yeah, but I loved when McCain went to the Western Wall and he said, wait, this looked a lot better when it was new.
That's true. They haven't kept it up. Actually, he pointed out where he scratched his name in.
His initials are there in the wet.
He also said this week that Purim, the Jewish holiday, was the Jewish Halloween, and he had to apologize for that, too. True fact. He said that. Very good. Here is your last quote.
Happy birthday, name redacted.
That was the entry from December 12, 1993. It's an example of the rather strange whiting out of the details in someone's daily schedule. Those voluminous schedules were released this week. The schedules of whom?
I would say that would be Hillary Clinton.
Right. The National Archives released thousands of pages of Hillary Clinton's calendar of events during her husband's presidency. And while they do show that Mrs. Clinton was there for many of the big foreign policy events of her husband's presidency, she mostly went in classic first lady mode. At summits, she was relegated to what's rather humiliatingly called the spousal bus. What was most interesting... But that's what they call it. That's what they call it. Carl, how did Simon do in our quiz?
Simon had three correct answers. Peter, he wins our prize.
Good work, Simon.
All right,
hey,
Simon.
Thank you.
Now we move on to our final game, Lightning Fill-in-the-Blank. Each of our players will have 60 seconds in which to answer as many fill-in-the-blank questions as he or she can. Each correct answer now worth 2 points. Carl, can you give us the scores?
Charlie Pierce has the lead, Peter. He has 3 points. P.J. O'Rourke and Kerry O'Connor are tied for second. Each has 2.
We flipped a coin. Kiri has decided to go first, so here we go. The clock will start when I begin your first question. Fill in the blank. According to a CNN poll, 3/4 of Americans think that the U.S. economy is in a blank.
Recession?
Right. Atlanta's CNN Center is still closed after it was hit by a blank last weekend.
Tornado.
Right. From Texas to Pennsylvania, thousands of people left their homes to escape early spring blank.
Flooding.
Right. The Supreme Court heard arguments as to whether Washington, D.C.'s ban on blanks is constitutional.
Handguns.
Right. 15-year-old Destiny Hope Cyrus this week filed papers to legally change her name to blank.
Miley?
Miley Cyrus. Yep. A woman sunbathing on a boat off the Florida Keys was killed when a blank leapt up and hit her.
A ray.
Exactly. Now they're mad at us. In Italy, a prisoner rewarded for his good behavior was picked to visit the Pope and blanked during his visit to the Vatican.
Escape?
Exactly. Angelo Di Gennaro was a model inmate at the prison in central Italy, so what could be risky about letting him out for a special audience with Pope Benedict?
Oh, go for it.
Yes. He continued being a model prisoner right up to the moment he ran away. Prison officials were embarrassed by the incident, said the next time they'll know better than to let their prisoners travel with special guards Laurel and Hardy. Carl, how did Kiri do on our quiz?
Kiri had 7 correct answers for 14 more points.
Whoa,
she has 16
impressive.
Points and the lead.
Okay, PJ, you're up next. Here we go. Once again, the Federal Reserve cut a key blank, this time by 3/4 of a point.
Interest rates.
Right. France's foreign minister suggested a boycott of the opening ceremonies of the Beijing Olympics because of China's crackdown in blank.
Tibet.
Right. Inspectors speculate that a broken nylon strap may have caused the blank collapse in New York City.
A crane.
Right, a construction crane. Although the city council asked him to step down, Kwame Kilpatrick refused to resign as mayor of blank.
Detroit.
Right. A man in Germany accused of driving while using a cell phone was acquitted after he told the court he was simply blank.
Listening.
No, using it as an ear warmer. North Carolina, Kansas, UCLA, and Memphis got the top seeds in the blank tournament.
The NCAA March Madness basketball tournament.
Exactly right. In response to a new Louis Vuitton campaign, Ad Age polled readers and found that more than half said no, they wouldn't want blank as the face of their brand.
Elliot Spitzer.
No. Keith Richards. More leathery than the bags, apparently. That was the problem. The romance between Petra, a black swan in Germany, and the blank she fell in love with 2 years ago is officially over.
The swan boat.
The swan boat, yes. As we reported on this very show.
On this very show.
You heard it here first, ladies and gentlemen. We're on the swan and inanimate object romance beat. For 2 years, Petra the swan refused to migrate and instead lived with her plastic boat boyfriend at a zoo in Münster, Germany. He was silent and cold, but very stable. In December, Petra met Paul, a live swan who could do things that the boat never could, like move without firing up an outboard. The two are now happily nesting together, and the zoo has taken the opportunity to give the spurned boat to a nearby rental service. Carl, how did PJ do in our quiz?
PJ had 6 correct answers for 12 more points. He now has 14, but Kiri still has the lead with 16 points.
Ooh, well done. All right, so how many then does Charlie need to win?
7, correct.
7?
Oh!
Tall order, my friend. Here we go. This is for the game. Charlie, fill in the blank. More than 7 months after President Bush commuted his prison sentence, an appeals court officially disbarred former White House aide blank.
Scooter Libby.
Right. According to the Wall Street Journal, black, American, and white were the 3 words uttered the most by blank in his big speech this week.
Barack Obama.
Right. Democrats in both Florida and Michigan failed to pass plans to hold new blanks.
Primary elections.
Right? In an audio tape released this week, Osama bin Laden accused blank of helping launch a new crusade against Islam.
Keith Richards.
Pope Benedict. According to a survey released this week, nearly half of all Japanese people take a bath with their blank.
Spouse.
No cell phone. Sean P. Diddy Combs denied a Los Angeles Times report that said he had advanced knowledge of an attack on blank.
Good taste.
No, Tupac Shakur. Tupac Shakur, the rapper. Winner of the Best Actor Oscar in 1966 for A Man for All Seasons, blank, died this week at the age of 86.
Paul Scofield.
Yes, indeed. A 15-year-old California girl who stopped an out-of-control school bus was given blank for her actions.
Detention.
Exactly right. Amanda, did you know that or did you just guess?
No, it was detention.
Yes, it was detention. Amanda Rouse wasn't feeling well, so she got a lift back home on a school bus with 40 elementary school students. So when the bus driver fell out of the seat, hit her head, Rouse was able to jump up, apply the brakes, keeping the students from harm, stopping the bus from hitting more than 2 parked cars. Her reward, Saturday detention. because her school said if she was sick, she should have reported to the school office and not gone gallivanting around performing deeds of derring do.
Oh, for Pete's sake.
For Pete's sake.
I hope she lawyers up.
Yeah. PJ's impatient with our litigious society, but damn it.
Yeah, there are limits.
Carl. Carl, did Charlie do well enough to win?
He needed 7 correct answers, but Charlie had just 5 correct answers.
Charlie.
So with 16 points, Kerry O'Connor is this week's champion.
All right. Not like the 34 that Roxanne usually gets, but...
It was enough.
It was enough. That's right.
In just a minute, we'll ask our panelists to predict what will be the next sign that our economy is tanking. But first, let me tell you all that support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the members of the National Association of Realtors, working on behalf of America's residential and commercial property owners, on the web at realtor.com. The Annenberg Foundation, advancing public well-being through improved communication, on the web at annenbergfoundation.org. And the Wallace Foundation, supporting ideas, sharing solutions, expanding opportunities, on the web at wallacefoundation.org. Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me is a production of NPR and Chicago Public Radio in association with Urgent Haircut Productions. Doug Berman, executive producer. Philip Goedeker writes our limericks. Our intern is Joe Feldman. Our house manager is Don Hall. Our web guru is Beth Novi. Our technical directors are Lorna White and Robert Newhouse. Other engineers include Gary Yek, Les Dolarchik, and Muhammad Mao. Thanks to John Zajac at Chase Bank. B.J. Lederman composed our theme. Our program is directed by Melody Kramer and produced by Mike Danforth and Emily Ecton. The senior producer of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me is Rod Abid. Now, panel, what will be the next sign that our economy has stalled? Mr. Charlie Pierce.
I'm sorry, Governor Switzer. $8,000 gets you only a handshake and a free T-shirt from the gift shop.
Kerry O'Connor.
You know that homeless guy who hangs out by the parking garage?
No.
He only takes Euros.
And P.J. O'Rourke.
When people can't afford the cheap thrills, you know, when they can't afford the cheap thrills, when a paparazzi gets in his car and a crowd of blonde airheads with no underwear block him in, that will be a bad sign.
Well, if any of those things happen to the economy panel, we'll ask you about it on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.
Thank you, Carl Castle. Thanks also to Charlie Pierce, P.J. O'Rourke, and Kerry O'Connor. Thanks, all of you, for listening. I'm Peter Sagal. We will see you next week. This is NPR, National Public Radio.